Hey guys, and welcome back to episode 18 of Underrated, a podcast where we look at films we believe are underrated, generally disliked, or simply forgotten. I'm your host, Gabriel Green, the hapless son of Santa who's all heart, and with me is my co-host, James Hamrick, the cantankerous and irascible former Santa who doesn't hold with all this newfangled technology stuff. What's up, dude?
Nothing much. It's all overrated. All of that technology is. We don't need it.
Yeah. So, it's Christmas, or not yet, but it will be when this episode comes out, and this is our Christmas episode. So today we are looking at the 2011 Aardman animation film, Arthur Christmas. But before we get into that, I'd like to ask you, if you enjoy this podcast, to please subscribe and rate and review us on iTunes. That would really bump us up in the rankings and allow people to find us easier. It doesn't have to be a long review, but just a few words and a five-star review would be tremendously appreciated. All right, and before we move on, have you seen any cool movies this week that you want to talk about?
Well, I've seen a movie, not a cool movie. last Christmas, me and a bunch of friends, we made it a habit of just watching many, many Hallmark Christmas movies.
Oh my gosh, why?
And they are all horrible, because watching those movies in a group setting is incredibly fun. They're so bad. So this year, we haven't watched, and I guess technically we still haven't watched one, because the one we watched last night was on a channel called Up TV, though it was very Hallmark in quality and just everything about it. And I just want to talk about some really weird things that happened in this movie. it's called, one, the movie itself is interesting, it's called 3-Day Christmas, which it has an alternate title called 3-Day Test. I'm not sure which title is used. It's directed by Corbin Burnson, the actor who plays Sean's dad from the show Psych. He wrote, directs, and has a part in the movie, and his character is completely unnecessary to the story, so clearly he just wanted to be in it. The movie is about this dad who feels like he's lost touch with his children, and so his crazy end-of-the-world survivalist brother gives him this disc, or like this DVD of this guy saying that the best way to reconnect with your family is to shut off all of your power, your electricity, your water, every source to the outside, give away your phones, and just live in your house without leaving for 3 days, and that's sure to get your family back together.
Yeah, great idea. Kids love that.
For future reference, whenever I become a father, I'm going to try to keep this little moral, this lesson in mind, because I may try this. But the first 2 days are about just them kind of surviving, and then for some reason in the second day, it has his brother, his survivalist brother, saying, like, breaking into his house and stealing his stuff, and then all of a sudden they're like, oh yeah, we've always been competitive. And so day three essentially turned into a very lesser in quality Home Alone, with them setting traps for his brother.
Is his brother evil?
Evidently, his brother initially was just kind of portrayed as this crazy survivalist guy who was like, hey, if you want to get your family together, do this. And then he does that, and then he's like, hey, I'm going to come over and steal your dog and your food and stuff. And he's very clearly portrayed as the antagonist at that point. But he wasn't beforehand, and it doesn't really explain why he feels the need to steal anything. It's the most forced conflict I've ever seen in a movie. But the weird things that I want to talk about, like, there's a moment, they buy a Christmas tree that's too tall for their living room, and so they have to cut the top part of it off. And there's a moment where the main character walks to the living room, he's going to his office, he works as an accountant, and he's going to do his work there. And he looks over at the Christmas tree, and the Christmas tree audibly says, "You destroyed me." And the dad looks at him and is like, "Oh yeah, well, you were too tall." And he goes and he sits at his desk, and the movie doesn't address that ever again. He talks to his tree, says something to him, and he replies to the tree, and the movie continues. And there is no reference to that. Evidently, we're just supposed to get on board with the idea that this guy can talk to Christmas trees, but it not once brings that fact up. It's so weird.
So I guess you had a good time?
Oh, it was a lot of fun. It was me and a couple of my friends. By the time I got there, everybody else had gone to sleep. And so one of my friends was like, hey, we got this movie. It looks horrible. Let's watch it. Like, all right, I'm down for that.
Okay, I might have to take that up as a tradition in the future.
Oh, it's a lot of fun.
All right. Well, I actually saw a whole bunch this week. The first one I saw was the 2005 Bruce Willis thriller Hostage. I thought it was okay. Have you seen this film?
I have not seen it.
Yeah, you don't hear much about it. And it was fine. I think it started with a really strong opening sequence, and the setup is good. And it feels like one of those mindless thrillers that's trying to be something more, trying to be really deep and moving and be meaningful, but it's really not. So, while it's all of it's fairly competent, it just doesn't really go anywhere. And as the story goes on, it gets just more and more over the top and ridiculous, which really clashes with the really serious tone they're going for. And Bruce Willis is very good. I think this was before he started phoning it in for a career. He actually gives a really, really great performance here. Ben Foster's in it as a psychopath, which is a shocker there. He's never done that before. But it's crazy because he looks so young in this movie, even though it's only like 10 years ago, but he looks like a teenager. But I actually thought he was pretty bad in this one. He just plays...
Really?
Yeah, he just plays... I think because his character was so painfully underwritten that he just spends the entire time with like this wide-eyed stare that he is like... So he just... It feels like a collection of bizarre cliches that he's seen from other psychopaths in movies. Like he's trying to do a Hannibal Lecter without the charisma or whatever. So, and just as it goes, it's okay. It's not terrible, but it just kind of gets really silly by the end. And then I was sick for a day or two, so I marathoned the entire second season of Ash versus the Evil Dead. Are you familiar with the Evil Dead franchise?
I've only seen the very first one, and I've never seen the show, but it sounds like something that I would really enjoy. So it's something that I plan on watching. I should have watched it during the Halloween season.
Yeah, this franchise is bizarre. And like the first one is crazy because like the second one is essentially a direct remake of the first one, but it's called Evil Dead 2. And the first one is still part of the canon. It's bizarre. But it's like, you know how Sam Raimi's Spider-Man films kind of exist in a slightly heightened reality where all the colors are all brighter, the characters just act bigger, and everything's just brighter and bigger, kind of more dynamic. Yeah. Imagine if that was like all the bigger elements were dialed to 10 and then drowned in laughable amounts of blood and gore, and you have the Evil Dead franchise. It's amazing. This one, I think that the first season basically distilled everything incredible about this series into this perfect, gross, whatever, season of television. The second one is not as tight, and I think the story starts to get a little repetitive, but it's still really fun. The character of Ash Williams, as played by the one and only Bruce Campbell, I'm not sure if Bruce Campbell's actually a good actor, but they found the perfect role for him as this just crude, arrogant, and completely charismatic shotgun-wielding chainsaw hand demon slayer. You know, he has roles in all the cameos in all the Spider-Man films. He's the wrestling announcer in the first one, the doorman for Mary Jane's theater in the second one, and the French waiter in the third one. Mm-hmm. So he's really funny in all those, but in this one, he's so perfect. He's just so much fun to watch as he spouts off these horrific one-liners as he's killing demons. And this whole series is a blast, but it's definitely not for you if you have a weak stomach at all, because there is extreme amounts of gross-out humor and gore. So, but it's fun if you can handle it.
Nice. That sounds like something I really do want to check out, because I'm a huge fan of Bruce Campbell. I think he's incredibly entertaining. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you'd want to watch Evil Dead 2 and Army of Darkness before you get into that, though, before you get into the series, because there's a lot of continuity. I also saw Taika Waititi's Hunt for the Wilder People, which is Taika Waititi is the director of Thor Ragnarok, which is a very, very weird choice. He's this really quirky New Zealand indie director. And this one, it's about a young kind of a troublemaker who's in the foster care system, and he's sent out into the hills of New Zealand to live with his husband and wife. The husband's played by Sam Neill, who's like completely unrecognizable in this film. He's like a really cantankerous old mountain man. And so just a bunch of hijinks ensue, and then the young boy and Sam Neill are kind of thrown out into the wilderness on the run from authorities on this massive manhunt over the island. And it's a really gorgeous film. It's in New Zealand, and he really makes use of the great locations. It's funny because you actually see an entirely different aspect of New Zealand than you see in the Lord of the Rings films. I didn't know they had anything else to show, but this film takes place in almost jungle-like settings, or just out in the deep bush. And I really enjoy this film. Taika Waititi has a very quirky sense of humor. It wasn't as funny as I was expecting, having seen What We Do in the Shadows, which is a mockumentary he made about vampires, which is also excellent. But it's really quirky and very heartfelt. I was actually surprised by how well the two characters got along. They're so completely different. Like, Sam Neill is amazing. He's just a really gruff, grumpy old man who doesn't know how to connect with people. And then you have kind of the troubled youngster, and they kind of bond on their trip. It's just really funny, great heart. It's just a really sweet film if you get a chance to see it.
Yeah, I want to say I've only seen What We Do in the Shadows, and I was a very big fan of that. It was one of the funniest movies of the year, in my opinion. So
yeah, I love that one too.
Him taking on Thor Ragnarok is very interesting.
It made me
more interested in seeing Thor than I was before.
Yeah, I think this film shows that he can handle decent action as well. So I'm not terribly worried on that front. Often you have these new directors, they just don't know how to helm large scale action. And from what I've seen, I think he can do it. I hope. And the last film I saw was Robert Zemeckis' World War II romance Allied, and I really enjoyed this movie. It's he's taking these obvious kind of homages and influences from like classic films like the 1950s. I mean, I haven't seen Casablanca, but from what I know about it, there's a lot of borrowed material here. But I really enjoyed this film. It's very deliberately paced, and it's just really, really gorgeous. Robert Zemeckis is a master. Just, especially in his recent films, every shot is like the most perfect and dynamic and beautiful shot you could have possibly made with that angle and or of what those people are doing. The entire film is gorgeous. The cinematography is insane. And the cast is great. I mean, I really like Brad Pitt, but Marion Cotillard, she's like the real star. I mean, she was incredible in this movie. Every scene with her, the amount of layers and just complexity she could bring to just a single stare is insane. She's like coming to be one of my favorite actresses. But my main problem with this film is the ending. I think it feels kind of anticlimactic, but just the journey there. It's just a really well-made film, very gorgeous, just beautiful people in beautiful settings doing beautiful things. It's just a very glamorous movie. And if you like the kind of filmmaking of the 1950s, this movie's for you. And has some really good. I like the romance. I like the tense thriller aspects. I think everything about it is really well done. Except the story could have used a little bit of work. So it doesn't like reach like the heights of this ravishing romance that I think Zemeckis was going for. But it's a very sturdy film.
Yeah, I want to watch it. I'm an enormous fan of Casablanca. I think it's one of, just in terms of start to finish and its script and plot and pacing, it's one of the best movies ever made. So if it's anything like that, I'll probably really enjoy it. But maybe me loving Casablanca might be a negative thing because I'm going to watch this. I'm like, man, I'm just going to go watch Casablanca now.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't seen Casablanca, but I did enjoy this one. All right. Is there anything you want to mention before we move on?
I think I'm ready.
All right. Let's move into our main review of Arthur Christmas. Arthur Christmas was released in 2011, produced by Aardman Animation. It was directed by Sarah Smith on a budget of $100 million. It only grossed back $147 million, so it likely didn't break even if you count in the marketing budget. It stars a pretty amazing voice cast, James McAvoy, Jim Broadbent, Hugh Laurie, Bill Nighy, and Imelda Staunton, who thankfully isn't the absolute definition of evil in this film, and Ashley Jensen. And the score was composed by Harry Gregson-Williams. All right, James, I'll let you read the brief synopsis.
Santa's clumsy son, Arthur, gets put on a mission with Saint Nick's father to give out a present they misplaced to a young girl in less than 2 hours. It's a very straightforward plot description.
It's a little too. All right, this film is an old favorite of mine, but this is your first time seeing it. What did you think of it?
I actually really enjoyed it. You talked it up a lot, and I was like, man, I don't know if I'm going to like it that much, but it ended up really... It's a movie that I liked enough to where I'm going to be going down to my parents, and I may actually be like, hey guys, this is a really nice Christmas movie. We should watch this one.
That's awesome. Really, really, really glad to hear that. I was worried you wouldn't like it, then I was like, we'd have a fight on our hands. All right. Yeah, and I love this movie. We discovered it a couple years back, and I think it's Aardman Animation's only full CGI film. Are you terribly familiar with Aardman?
I think the only other film by them that I've seen was Chicken Run, which is amazing. So
yes.
After I found out it was Aardman, and that being the only thing I knew from them, I was like, okay, well, I'm sure this would be really good because I love that movie.
Yeah, Chicken Run's fantastic. Yeah, I grew up on Aardman, all the Wallace and Gromit shorts, and then when they came out with their full full-length film, that's amazing. And then their Pirates film is also hysterically funny. So I was a huge fan of Aardman. It's very British, but it's not nearly as British as like their Wallace and Gromit films. And this one's a bit more commercialized, but it still has all of the wit and heart of their other films. I'm just going to start with my positives. One of my main praises for this film is just how clever it is with how it takes all the traditional folklore surrounding Santa and then gives a realistic quote-unquote answer to it all. Like, how does Santa deliver all these presents to every kid around the world? Well, obviously he has this giant UFO and thousands of militarized elves to do it. I mean, obviously. But it's just the entire opening sequence where you have Santa coming over a city and delivering presents to every kid in there. It's like this really brilliantly conceived Mission Impossible sequence. And the amount of jokes and sight gags just in that one sequence alone is insane. Like, you could fill an entire movie. Like, as the elves are moving through the house, you can see, like, in the background fixing a soup and, like, changing the temperature on the turkey. Or there's, like, in the background one, there's, like, an elf limping away with a mouse trap. And, like, oh, you're going to make a soldier. It's just a really fun sequence. It looks like a Mission Impossible sequence with how it's constructed. And it's really clever. And even more than that, I love how they go back in time and explain how the old Santas did it before all this technology, where they had this crazy tricked out sled that's like a puzzle box with a magic anti-gravity gas that lets the reindeer fly. It's just a really clever and funny explanation of all the lore. And I think they do a good job of explaining it all and making it believable enough within an animated film.
Yeah, that's one of the positives that I have. I had listed as well, is just their version of this myth, and I really do like that opening scene a lot. It was I remember I rewatched it, or I let the scene finish out, and I noticed that there's a bunch of stuff going on in the background, so I rewound it, and there's just so many funny little things that you probably missed the first time, or even the second time, just going on in the background of elves jumping through windows in the background and replacing this with that. Just a lot of different gags going on that are actually really funny. The way they'll suck up the milk and they'll have the fake teeth bite the carrot. Like all of their explanations for all of this stuff just to try to continue to sell this idea that Santa's coming into every single one. It's really funny.
Yeah, and then you have the crisis sequence where the kid wakes up with Santa in the room and they have this really tense moment where they have to like do this real careful incision into a box to turn off the noisy toy. Like, oh, it's just like whatever 1964 where Santa was trapped. No Christmas for 6 years. I love the elves in this movie. They're so funny.
Yeah, I was about to say, something really interesting, whenever I was looking up this movie, some of the actors they got for the elves, apparently Andy Serkis plays one of the elves.
Yeah, and, it's crazy.
Joan Cusack and Rhys Darby from Flight of the Conchords all have roles as elves, and their voices are so high-pitched it's hard to tell who's who, but I was trying to listen the whole time, like, is that him? But
yeah, I tried to listen. I don't know who's in there, but it's I like watching the credits. It's like, who? What? Where are all these people in there?
Yeah, there's some really funny choices for elves in there.
Yeah, Robbie Coltrane, Dominic West. I mean, what? It's insane.
But I think the elves get some of the best lines in the film. The one that one of the ones that made me laugh the most was whenever he says, "What happened to what about good or peace
and goodwill to all men?"
Oh, they didn't say anything about elves. Like, just there's a lot of there's also like some almost dark humor in it. Whenever Arthur apologizes for melting down the elf homes, and I love whenever you just hear random like throwaway lines in the background, because just you hear one elf shout, "I lost everything in that flood."
Yeah. That is why British humor is infinitely superior to anything Americans do. There's so much more clever.
Yeah, they're really witty. It's really dark, but it's never like just depressingly dark. Like even when it's always funny.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like this is a more child appropriate version of that British humor, but it didn't feel watered down in terms of how funny it actually was.
Yeah, Aardman's always been a master of that. That's why they'll always be the kings of stop motion. I'm sorry, Laika, but
so another thing that I liked a lot about this that we pretty much just started talking about was the humor and how clever it is sometimes in the movie. I think they use the age gap between the Santas to very humorous effect, like because you can kind of see it. And the current Santa, who's been operating as Santa for 72 years, and then you get even more hand with Bill Nighy's Santa, you know, who said, they used to think you couldn't teach women to read. Like, all of these references to their age, and a lot of it is really funny, and a lot of the jokes, I'm like, man, I bet if this were another studio, they probably wouldn't have, you know, had these rewritten or wouldn't have included these just because, like, oh, kids aren't going to laugh at this. But there's a lot of really funny lines. But I was even laughing at some of the stuff that's meant for kids to laugh at. Whenever he goes and he's calling on the reindeer and he forgets, and he's like, all right, Bambi, John, you with the white ear, and you.
Yeah, I love how that comes back in the end, too, with the postcard ending with all the reindeer.
That part actually had me laughing out loud. Like, because, you know, everything before, you know, so-and-so went off to do this and they were happy. I was like, oh, you know, look, this is a nice ending. And then it showed that. I legitimately just started laughing out loud in a room by myself. I'm just sitting there laughing. And
yeah, I was also by myself and I was laughing throughout the entire film. It's like everything out of Bill Nighy's mouth in this movie is just pure comic gold.
He's got some of the best lines. So I said elves have some of the best lines. I think Bill Nighy has the best lines.
Yeah. Christmas of 1862, had a heart attack at the reins. That ventricle popped out of my mouth, shoved it back down, and kept going.
So many like I honestly just wish that I could find like a compilation of all of his lines. I a lot of my positives could just be me reading his portion of the script, because
at least had the decency to finish us off with a rock.
See, there was stuff like that, and then after he gets caught on the sleigh as it goes past, and he's just sitting with Byrony as Arthur's off, and he's like, "So how do you fancy being the one to tell his folks about this?"
I didn't know it was a Cuban Missile Crisis.
And I watched the movie with subtitles just because I wanted to make sure that I would be able to see all, because there's a lot of lines he speaks just really fast. There's a lot of lines being shouted in the background, and
yeah,
it's got really, really funny writing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't even know it was Bill Nighy the first time I watched until like the credits. But I love Bill Nighy so much. He's got one of the best voices. Yeah, so my next positive is just the entire cast. The entire cast is incredible. I mean, they're so perfectly cast. You have like Jim Broadbent, who is like the most adorable old man ever, and he plays that in the character of the current Santa Malcolm, which I think that's also brilliant, where just Santa is a title passed down from father to son throughout all the years, and then that's a really funny concept. And you have basically three generations of Santas all together for a family Christmas. It's pretty hilarious. And then, yeah, he's incredible. Then you have Hugh Laurie, who's always amazing. He plays kind of the high-functioning, emotionless executive older brother who's next in line to the title of Santa. But he just doesn't get Christmas. He's great at his job. But he just doesn't get Christmas. And then you have James McAvoy. I mean, he's the definitive Professor X to me. And but he's Arthur, which is a very different role from that. He's a completely hapless and incompetent guy who completely believes and loves everything about Christmas and who's completely committed to the children getting like the best possible experience. He's such an adorable character. And like his dynamic with the crotchety, cantankerous Grand Santa is pretty hysterical.
I think everybody does a really good job of playing like their own distinct take on that Santa, with their own like unique personalities. And I mean, of all of them, Grand Santa probably still is my favorite, just because Bill Nighy is given the best lines whenever they're trying to get to Truett, and he's like, I don't need your technology. I just use the North Star as a fixed point. It's clear, just a plane flying by. Yeah. We always used to, the Santas always would come through Canada. Nobody lives here.
This is a city. Oh, the bloody cheek. They're always putting these up.
I'll add a few more of these sky scratches on this map.
How old is this thing? Atlantis.
So, yeah, he's my favorite of them all. I think he's got the best lines, but I do think that Jim Broadbent and Hugh Laurie do play their respective Santas to perfection. I really like Jim Broadbent. He's just got a voice that's easily super easy to recognize, and I like the way he plays all his roles, from the professor in Chronicles of Narnia to I really enjoy him in Hot Fuzz. I think he's perfect for that role. It's just this kind of, small town police officer, but he was really good in this one. I think my favorite line from him is whenever he and his son are arguing and his wife tells him, "Stop bickering." He's like, "Oh, I'm not bickering, it's Steve." And then he goes and instantly messes up the UFO. He's got several good lines, and I think he plays the role, especially towards the end, with a lot of heart too, which is another thing this movie had that I'll talk about later that I liked about a lot about, is it wasn't just this like silly, funny Christmas movie that just kind of comes and goes. It actually has a lot of heart to it, I think.
Yeah, it has all the fast-paced humor and just like gags per minute as any DreamWorks film, but it also has all the heart of a Pixar film as well. Actually, you want to... So do you have a positive you want to go on now?
Well, I'd also like to just mention, still on the subject of the cast, kind of we talked about it a little bit earlier, is the elves, you know, I'm not sure which elf was who, but they did a good job. Because I was thinking, you know, if you can't really recognize the actors' voices, what's the use in hiring all of these well-known actors? And I guess it's probably just because, you know, if you hire unknowns, you know, comedic timing, from what I've heard, like in interviews with actors, having really good comedic timing and comedic delivery is more difficult than being able to act in like a dramatic scene.
Mm-hmm.
Like it, and so I guess they just wanted to make sure that they got people they knew could like deliver these lines without sounding cheesy, or just making sure that all these lines that are really funny on paper sound funny. And so all of the elves did their part really well. And I did like Byrony a lot. I thought she was given a lot of really good lines. She was the only one who's, well, not the only one. There's a lot of elves who are given very distinct voices. I like the, I'm not sure if he's named or not, but the elf who's obsessed with, you know, making sure that everything is ready for Steve as he becomes Santa. He has a lot of good lines.
Peter. Please let go of my hand.
And then I didn't mention Hugh Laurie as Steve. He plays that role well, like almost any role Hugh Laurie is in. He plays it with that perfect kind of voice that just encapsulates everything British. Like, he's got the most British voice I think there is.
Yeah.
And so, you know, obviously I really enjoyed him as Steve, because it's hard to not enjoy Hugh Laurie.
Yeah, they're all of them are very British, but they each character kind of encapsulates a certain aspect of personality, where he has like he's very polite, but he still has that very clipped and completely perfunctory tone. And then you got the quiet, lovable grandfather kind of quality with Jim Broadbent, and then the cantankerous old man kind of thing. But they're all really British with. So, and just going off kind of the actors, I love that this film, it doesn't have a villain, and all the characters are given decent arcs. And like, as I said, there's no antagonist. It's just a bunch of different characters with differing perspectives, and no one is really wrong. Each character has their own positives and their own flaws. You have like Arthur, he's all heart, and he's kind of he makes up for all the apathy from like his dad and brother, but he's also completely incompetent and useless just about. But he still has he has the heart and understands what Christmas is. Like he by himself, he couldn't be Santa by himself. He just doesn't have what it takes. And then you have like a Hugh Laurie, who's highly competent and is basically the one running Christmas, as we see in the beginning of the film. But he doesn't have the heart. He doesn't understand the emotions and what makes Christmas special. It's just a job to him. But you need him to be able to deliver presents to however many billion children. And then you have, I think one of my favorite arcs is the father, where you can see that by the time this film comes around, he's pretty useless. He's just a figurehead. He comes down, he'll lay his one present down, but all of the work is actually done by Steve and his elves, but he's clinging on to this title of Santa because he's afraid if he lets go, he'll lose his entire identity. And I really like his arc of coming to it where, even though he really does nothing, he still thinks he's Santa and he's the one who gets the job done, even though he's just an old man who kind of just falls asleep and lays one present down. And I think his arc of coming to learn to appreciate from before, he would take all the credit and then lay all the blame at Steve's feet if anything went wrong. Then he kind of learns to appreciate Steve. I like how Steve wasn't just a complete jerk. He's just trying to get his job done. And you could also, I like his relationship with Malcolm, Jim Broadbent's character, where he kind of feels underappreciated because he's the one doing all the work, but his father doesn't acknowledge it. It's a really great family dynamic, and the characters are given way more depth than we needed.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said. I did really enjoy the fact that there wasn't this antagonist that was shoehorned into the movie. Like, the movie was able to function on its own, and it easily could have pulled something from the Christmas, you know, kind of myth or whatever, and tried to say, uh-oh, now we have this extra wrinkle in the story, but they didn't. They just They relied on the characters that they already had, and they didn't kind of push one character towards, like, okay, well, this is our film's antagonist. Like you said, everybody has their own pros and cons, and I actually do like the arcs of the two older Santas the best. Not that the two younger ones didn't have good ones, but it was the more, you know, like, he's the clumsy guy who understands what it's all about, and everybody's going to learn Christmas magic from him, and then the older brother who, you know, he doesn't quite get it, but he's, you know, he's this guy who understands the way the world works and all this, but he still needs to be taught this. Like, they're good arcs, and I really did enjoy them, because like you said, they weren't necessary for this kids' movies. But I really like the ones that the two older Santas go, like what you said with the current Santa who feels like his identity is just so attached with his job that, you know, he doesn't want to become his father. Because he sees his father who's, you know, just this old cranky man who's kind of dismissed by everybody else, and he wants
rightfully
to make sure
so.
That that's, yeah. So he doesn't want to feel like that's him, and he's, you know, trying to retain this identity and this job for as long as he can, unwilling to pass it on. And then you have the oldest Santa, the Grand Santa, who can very much tell that that's the way he's perceived, as this old man who's kind of just there, you know, his days of being useful are gone, and he wants to prove to him, to everyone else, his son and his grandkids, that, you know, it was the old way that was the best, you know. And something that I like that this movie didn't do, which it could have, was I really don't like it when movies try to say that, like, see, it's the old ways of getting it done that are the best.
Yeah.
Like, you got you kids and y'all's technology. It acknowledges, like, yeah, like whenever he was talking about the sleigh in the scene just before it gets destroyed, and he's like, you know, Evie's not meant for this world anymore, but I'm just glad that I got one last ride out of her. So it's this idea that of people understanding that, you know, the world is changing, and it's not necessarily for a bad thing, and kind of coming to terms with, you know, who you are and what your role is. It's just, it was really well done, I think, and it was never just the super easy, like, oh, we're so caught up in technology today that we forget the way things ought to be done. And it was, because that was the mindset that the Grand Santa had.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of said, oh, they didn't portray that as the positive thing, as if this old man who was stuck in his ways was in the right. And I feel like a lot of the time that usually is portrayed as the right thing. And just the fact that they were given these different characters these arcs, and they weren't necessarily portraying one as overtly better than the other, even though Arthur Christmas does end up becoming the new Santa. They don't really say that it's because he's better than anyone else. It's just he's better suited for this particular part of the job.
Yeah. Yeah, that was one of my big positives as well. It would have been so easy to just make this a old versus new film, or just old good, new bad. But I love that when it actually comes down to it, Grand Santa is just as cynical as Steve, just in a different way. His reasons for going on this quest to get the present to the girl is not because he actually cares about Christmas or believes in the magic of Santa any more than Steve does. It's just he wants to prove himself right. And I love how basically through Arthur's influence, each character kind of gets to learn what Christmas means. And I love in the ending how they all kind of converge on the house, and each one uses their gifts, like where morning's coming, and then Steve brings a spaceship and turns it back to night, and they all converge in the house, and then they all for the first time in their lives watch the present being opened. And you have Steve who just before that had a pretty disastrous experience with a little boy, just a hilarious scene.
Oh yeah, I was about to say, which is a very funny scene.
And so he's realizing that maybe he's all his life wanted to become Santa, and now he's realizing maybe I don't have what it takes. And as he's watching his brother with all the awe and wonder on his face of the kid unwrapping the present and believing that Santa brought it, and then he just kind of allows Arthur to take on the title of Santa. And the film still acknowledges that Arthur still very much needs Steve. Steve he keeps his job. He's still the one running the show, but he's staying to what he's good at, and Arthur is staying to what he's good at. It shows that it's not about being right or wrong. It's just about people doing what they're meant to do. And I like that. It's a much more nuanced message than you see in a lot of kids films.
One of the things that I really liked about this movie was that, like, what you said, just the idea that it was a lot more of a nuanced message than is in most kids' movies. Most kids' movies, I think a lot of people feel like, oh, what's a message that I guess people would be okay with in a kid's movie? You know, like, oh, you can do whatever you want to do it if you put your heart to it. And I feel like a lot of the people making it, like, all right, well, we'll just find a way to shoehorn that message into, I guess, one of the final scenes. And nobody's going to get mad that we told kids that. Mm-hmm. But this one is a lot more refined in its message, or like at least the way it presents it. And it's actually one of those messages that I can get behind, you know, like the idea, like, find something that you're good at and, you know, really stick to that. Because, I mean, this whole idea of whatever your heart desires can be your, like, I feel like this one is a lot more realistic lesson, and it's told in just as heartfelt of a way as all of these other children's movies are.
Yeah, because it confirms the importance of the evil corporate businessmen. We need those people for society to function. It's not like every person has their function, and their function is just as important as the next person's. It's just different. And you can't have too much of one. If you have too much of one, there's a failing on a different side, and it works both ways. It's nuanced, as you said.
And then, so, one of the last things that I have listed here for my positives is what we talked about a little bit earlier, and then just recently, was the kind of emotional heart that this movie has. It sets up its arcs early on, and you can kind of see that, I guess, in the first act of the movie, that it's going to be better than most kids' movies because they're actually starting to really show that there are layers to these characters. And I was really pleased in the way that they wrapped up everybody's arcs kind of together in the one scene as they watched the Gwen open her present.
Yeah.
Like, I maybe got slightly teary-eyed, but yeah. It was just a really well done scene, and I think it's because of the decision to not paint anyone as the genuine antagonist, because I feel like a lot of times whenever they have someone as the antagonist and then in the very end they're like, oh, he's come around, I'm like, I don't care, you've been a horrible person this whole movie, why would I care? But in this, you know, nobody's just a bad person. It's just, this guy is stuck in this way. This guy likes doing it like this. This guy wants this. It's, everybody feels very human. They've got very human flaws. And so to see everybody kind of acknowledge Arthur as the one who ought to be doing this. And there's not even really a lot of dialogue in that scene, but what is said is really done, like, is really well done. Like, the current Santa's line, you know, like, you know, in my day, a walnut and a pat on the back kind of, you know, it went a long way.
Mm-hmm.
It was a really nice scene, and it was a good payoff to where they had taken all the characters before that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really, at first I kind of knew that they were going to end up having Arthur take on the role of Santa. And I initially didn't like that. I was like, man, you know, they're just portraying this guy as this bumbling idiot, but just because he kind of knows the spirit of Christmas, they're going to give him all these responsibilities, and it's going to be a stupid message. But I was okay with it by the end. I was like, they kind of set this up that he is the one who needs to be doing this part of the job, because this part of the job is the part that requires the love about what's going on. These other characters aren't any less important, and they're still necessary, but I don't know, the way it all came together was very satisfying, and I would say, you know, rightly emotional ending.
Yeah, that entire climax sequence is so just adorable. I had a huge grin on my face the whole time as they're coming together. And I love that each one comes there for different reasons. Like Steve is trying to go there for the approval of his father. And you have Malcolm, the current Santa, he's going there because he's going there out of concern for his son, Arthur, who's off alone. And then they kind of all converge together, and then they're kind of brought together by the magic of Christmas as the kid. It sounds so cheesy, but the way the film plays it, it's just so sweet. Right? This movie for me is like it's the perfect Christmas film. It works on its own without any of the sentimentality around Christmas, just because it's a very tight script and tight story that's well told. But then it just taps into everything we love about this holiday. And I really, really appreciated that.
Yeah, it's definitely one that I'm probably going to be watching now during the Christmas seasons. For what you said, it is a good movie on its own. Like, this is a well-done movie. And then, you know, Christmas time, at least for me, I'm always generally in a more cheerful mood in December. I love the cold weather and seeing the lights and everything. So, you know, it's nice to just sit down and watch a movie that celebrates everything that I love about this time of the year. So, yeah, this was definitely a movie that I enjoyed, and I'm glad that we ended up doing.
Our one last positive I wanted to mention was the character of Byrony, the highly competent rapping elf. more movies need characters with a high-pitched, extremely fast Scottish accents. It's so adorable.
We have a lack of those in Hollywood today, yeah. I think.
I love the scene where she's trying to worry Arthur. All the kids around her, that's the girl that Santa hates. She runs away, alcoholic by the age of 9, dead by 12.
Yeah, that was another really good line. I'm like, man, they just talked about a little girl becoming an alcoholic. That is so British in its humor. So good.
Yeah, I mean, just this film, we keep saying it, but how many children's films have an arc of an old man with having an identity crisis about not wanting to leave his job? Like, I love that Aardman is making quote unquote children's films. That, like, I didn't really get that in my first few viewings. That arc only really hit me this last viewing because it's so nuanced and subtle. It's not shoved in your face. It's like just completely kind of unsaid in the background and things like that. This is a very smart film, and I really appreciated that. Do you have any more positives?
That was the last one that I had listed. I don't really have a long list of negatives either, but...
Mm-hmm. All right, I'll let you start with your negatives.
So the first one that I had was that... I understand, like, to go along with the idea that everybody has their own job that they're good at, as well as their own flaws. I think initially they may have done Arthur's clumsiness a little bit. It may have been a slightly overdone. Like,
it was his slippers.
It was his slippers. But it's essentially right at the beginning of the movie when the audience is supposed to begin to grow to like Arthur. He's being introduced to us. And we can already tell that this is a good person. This is going to be a character that we're going to like just from the scene of him reading the letters. But then before they can continue to allow us to develop this liking of this character, he's tripping over everything. And I get that he needed to be clumsy. We needed to understand why he wasn't really even in the running for Santa, why he wasn't considered for that, and why he feels kind of singled out, or not singled out, but just kind of, you know, forgotten, like he's, you know, overlooked. But, you know, as he spills coffee all over keyboards and rips computers, and I'm like, man, call me like the Scrooge of this movie. But if I were in those, I'd be like those elves. I'd be like, oh, can we put this guy where he's not going to do any harm? Like,
yeah, I understand that, but I do like. Any lesser film would have had the crisis be Arthur's fault, and this film doesn't do that. So, yeah, I understand maybe they do overdo it a bit, but I think they don't go where a lot of other films would have.
Yeah, I mean, I think that would have been crossing the line to where it would have been difficult for me to enjoy it is if he was the one who caused it, because then in the end he would be the one to save it, and they'd be like, Arthur saved the day, and I'd be like, yeah, but he caused it. I'm glad that they didn't do it this. I just think that they were portraying, and the way the current Santa did kind of really get him to the side and really not care about him was wrong. And the movie does portray that as wrong, but it almost feels like him being the letter guy was a bad thing. And in my mind, I'm like, at that moment in time, that's kind of where he needed to be. Because, you know, you can't get angry at these people for saying, you know, like, oh, you can't be a part of these departments when everything we've seen of him outside of that letter room has been disastrous.
Yeah. I do love the visual of his mailroom where you kind of going down the dark, cold corporate's kind of hallways. Then you kind of go into his room, and it's that really warm, like a very warmly lit with all kinds of colors and pictures. I like the contrast that was made for his character, even though he is knocking everything down as he goes. I actually don't have any dislikes for this film. There was one scene where I thought it would be a dislike, which is where you have kind of the mid-film crisis where Arthur kind of starts to lose heart after he gets the revelation that that Santa might not really be all that concerned. And at first I thought it felt kind of cliched and shoehorned in and forced, but then there's this really touching line where he says, where after he found out that his father just went to bed after missing a child, and he's just kind of completely devastated, and he has that, as Grand Santa's trying to cheer him up, he has that line, how can I ever write another letter that says Santa cares? Because up till then, his entire belief was that's Christmas. Santa has to come every night, and that's what Santa cares about. And you have the character Jim Broadbent, who's just, yeah, he cares, but he's old. He's kind of out of the loop. And that scene turned from being a dislike to actually something I really appreciated. I really felt that line when he said it, and I understood his kind of turmoil at that scene. And then when he realizes that Santa is the idea, it's not necessarily any one person, it's the idea that a child has when they wake up on Christmas morning and gifts are there. I really like that arc, and so it turned from being a dislike to a positive.
Yeah, that's essentially exactly how I felt about that scene as well. I was like, no, it, you know, we're halfway through the movie, and like any children's movie, we still need more padding to get to the end, so they're going to have this other conflict. But it was done in a really well-done manner, and it actually made sense for the story, and it was necessary for the arc of Arthur. And it was nice to see that was kind of whenever Bill Nighy's character was coming around, and he was beginning to grow and see that you know, Arthur had always been the most, I guess, excited about Christmas, and he had always provided that cheer. And so to see him all of a sudden so down, he's kind of begins the portion of his arc where he begins to grow as a character and understand that, you know, Christmas isn't really about the way that the Santas get their presents delivered, just that they get there, and ended up being a really nice scene.
I love the scene after that where he's singing as he was rowing, and then you have Grand Santa and Byron, you just kind of awkwardly staring at him. We need a blunt instrument.
I've heard about this.
Sleigh fever. Santa, whatever year got it, every child got a piece of sausage nailed to a piece of bark.
Again, we could just quote his character. Another scene that I know this is the dislike portion, but this has probably just become the portion of the episode where we talk about scenes that could have been a dislike, but ended up not being ones. The scene, I feel like, could have felt very similar to what we felt that this one that we're talking about currently could have felt like, which is the one where they get to Truett, but it's the wrong Truett. And
we're in the wrong Trelew.
Or Trelew, sorry. It's funny Because maybe like it essentially serves the same purpose that that kind of scene would serve in a lot of movies, where it's you just needed a way to make the, I guess, the adventure, the journey last longer. It's not really necessary for the plot. But in most movies, it's like, ugh, of course, like, of course something else happens, or they went to their own, like, it just feels so overdone. But in this, it's played in a really funny manner. And then they use the exact same joke again, but it works again.
Yeah, it's even more funny the second time.
I love it when we're seeing the scene from Steve's eyes, and we just see the small child being thrown around at this other dog that we've seen. It's both times it could have really felt like a way to just pad the story out. And even that may have been its purpose, you know, as they put together the screenplay. But it's funny enough to where it's like, it's not a negative because it's done so well.
Yeah, there's a lot of those jokes that come back around at the end. And I think that's really clever comedy, when you can have jokes, that kind of recurring jokes throughout that you don't expect to come back, but they do. And they manage to work that into Steve's character development as well, where he realizes just how bad he is with kids.
And I love that line when he gets back on board and is like, okay, so I don't like kids very much, but does that, or but do I have to for my job?
Does that make me a bad Santa?
Yeah. And nobody replies because, like, the punchline is essentially like, of course that makes you a bad Santa.
Yeah.
So, really, I don't know why I said the Arthur thing as if I had more, because I think that's actually the only thing I had listed here as a con, and that's such a small thing to say. I almost just felt like I had to have something negative to say.
Yeah, I was really searching. I really couldn't think of anything either. Because I guess there are elements that you can say are cliched, but they always turn them into something clever, so.
Yeah, and that's something, I don't like the idea that something being cliche is necessarily a bad thing if it's done in a really well done way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, there's only so many original things you can do, and at this point there's really nothing original. And I think we've talked about it in previous episodes, where there are just certain formulas that we stick to because they work, and I would say rightfully so. It's how you handle doing that. And so to say that, to list, you know, certain aspects of this movie being cliche as a negative just doesn't really feel right, given that it's done in a really quality way.
Yeah, I think that's where the difference between a trope and a cliche. I think a cliche is where they take a trope and they just do it, but without properly developing it and setting it up. That's where, like, so many lazily written films go, because they think, since we're familiar with this trope, if they do it without proper setup, we'll connect, because we've seen it in so many other films. I think that's what a cliche is. But I think tropes are just kind of storytelling formulas that they, if you set up a trope well, it'll hit you every time, just because that's how humans are wired for some reason. All right, so is there anything else you wanted to mention, or are you ready to move into your final thoughts for this?
Yeah, I'll move into my final thoughts. I am really glad that this is the episode we decided to do on Christmas, because I probably would have never have seen this movie otherwise. So if you're listening and you're looking for a new Christmas movie, even though, I mean, Lord knows we don't need any more. We've got so many.
Never.
But
we always need more.
That's true. I don't want to sound cynical, because I'm a huge fan of Christmas and I love Christmas movies. Even the bad ones, as we found out, because I thoroughly enjoyed watching 3 Day Christmas, as horrible as it was. This movie is absolutely worth being added to your Christmas movie roster, because it's got everything that a Christmas movie needs. It's got, I would say it actually has more humor than the average Christmas movie, certainly more than the average, like, children's Christmas movie. It's got more humor that works. It's a lot more clever than most. It's got a great cast. It has, you know, perfect messages for Christmas. it handles, you know, the mythology of these characters of Christmas in a really fun way. It's just, it's got everything that a Christmas movie needs to have, and then some more. And then not only does it have what a Christmas movie needs to have, but it has it, and it has it in a really well done way. So definitely worth a watch. One of the better animated Christmas movies.
Yeah, definitely. I agree with everything you said. Just, it's a very fast and witty film with brilliant British humor, but also it has every bit of heart that a Christmas movie needs. And it has Bill Nighy being one of the funniest characters I've ever seen in the film. I mean, there are so many more quotes I wrote down while I was watching this film. Like, half of my notes were just quotes from Grand Santa. He's such a funny character. Yeah, it's just, this is my favorite Christmas film, and I think it definitely fits the term underrated. Because honestly, before this year, I never heard about it anywhere online. I've seen recently it's developing a following of people who've discovered it, but it was kind of released and pretty quickly forgotten in 2011. And I'm really glad it's starting to finally develop a following, because it's so good. If you haven't seen this film, just go check it out. It's well worth a watch. As I said, this is my favorite Christmas film.
Maybe it'll have the "It's a Wonderful Life" effect, where, you know, it's not until a few years, several years actually, after its release before people realize how good it is.
Yep, we can only hope. Well, I hope you enjoyed that discussion. Next week, we are going to the Hobbit series. This is one of the films that we kind of started this podcast to defend, and I'm really pumped. There was a recent discussion thread on the Popcorn Theology page, which is an awesome movie discussion group, but where someone was saying that these films are worse than the prequels. So now that really got me up, rearing up to go and do this, because that I could take a lot of criticisms, but that one is that's too far. That's way too far.
Yeah, because, like, I mean, obviously we've already shown that we don't think that episode 3 is anywhere near as bad as 1 and 2. I actually, you know, really love episode 3, but
yeah,
episodes 1 and 2 are so horrifically bad that, man, I was in the same boat. I was reading some of these comments, and I was, I'm ready to film this episode, record this episode. I think what I'm going to have to do is make sure that I actually make succinct points that are clear to follow, as opposed to just going on rants and tirades, because it could very easily boil down to that, because, there's so many good things about this trilogy that people overlook for the sake of saying, look, he's got bird poop on his head. This is a stupid movie, see? It's like,
Yeah, I've had rants building up since the release of the first film in 2012, so I'm definitely ready to do this. All right, so again, I'd like to ask you, if you enjoy this podcast, to please, please go and rate and review us on iTunes and subscribe. It would definitely help us. And also, if you want to follow us, you can follow us on Facebook, like us there. We're on Facebook as Underrated Podcast. And feel free to comment with suggestions or thoughts you have on the podcast, ways we can improve it, or just if you have a suggestion of a film that you think is underappreciated, comment on there. And if we agree, we might even do an episode on it. We've already done a couple, one listener suggestion so far. Go like us on Facebook. We also have a website, underratedpodcast.com.
And then if you want to follow us on Twitter, we are underrated_pod. So if you don't have a Facebook or you just prefer Twitter, feel free to tweet suggestions for movies or comments, or like Gabe said, any ways we might improve. And then if you want to email us, we are theunderratedpodcast@gmail.com. So,
yeah, and I am also on Facebook as Gabriel Green. Feel free to shoot me a friend request. I love discussing movies with y'all and interacting with y'all on the page.
Yeah, same goes for me. I'm James Hamrick on Facebook. And if you love The Hobbit or other gems like these and just need someone else to confide in, I just need to talk about it sometimes. No, but I would, if you want to add me, talk about movies or whatever, that'd be great. I love talking about films. So, until next week when we begin this Middle-earth journey, I will see you later.
See ya. Someone to love is the answer. Once you've found her, build your
be happy too. Like torches blazed with light.